The first privilege is Vicksburg Group of Alcoholics Anonymous really said that I could introduce a speaker. That's really an honor. It's very important to me, and it's very important to me this time at this particular time. The second honor that's very important to me is I really get to introduce a speaker. And for those people that are about my age, and those people that used to watch TV, they may have kind of a fuzzy remembrance of who the individual is. I kind of generally, in a very gross sense, kind of know what he was, but I think I'm very, very honored today to really find out what he is. I'd like to introduce DDL speaker this evening.
Hello, everybody. I'm D.D. Lewis, and grateful alcoholic. I've been clean and sober since February the 10th, 1986, and I'm just as grateful as I know how to be for that. I'm nervous, as you can tell. I have to tell a couple of jokes before I get loosened up. I got here today, and Arthur B. Met me over here at the door, and he thought I was a girl. Because it's DDL, and it reminded me of the story when I was given an award in 1982, a Bart Starr Meritorious Award in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and my wife and I had to fly up there and receive an award, and so we were at the airport in Milwaukee, and they're supposed to send a chauffeur driven limousine for us to pick us up, and then we're at the airport, and nobody shows up to pick us up, and we're standing there with our luggage, and a guy keeps walking back and forth, and finally I said, "Hey, who are you looking for?" He said, "D.D. Lewis." I said, "I'm D.D. Lewis." He says, "No, you're not." I said, "Yes, I am. Here, look at my driver's license." And we get out, finally in the limo. He said, "Mr. Lewis, I got to apologize to you." He said, "I thought you were black." I've been a woman. I've been black, alcoholic. Now I'm sober, and I'm grateful for that. This is a real honor for me. I have been to your club many times. I'm in the fertilizer business, and I've been in and out of Vicksburg quite a bit. But every time I used to come and stay over here, I'd come to a meeting. I really enjoyed it. I no way realized the club was this big. So I'm going to tell what it was like and what happened and how it is today. And I got to tell you, I played with the Dallas Cowboys for 14 years. I was very fortunate. And right before you come up to speak, you know, what happens to me, I draw a blank. And then I start getting nervous. And because I don't get stage fright. And I always feel like in 1974, we played the Washington Redskins in Dallas. And Roger Staubach, our great quarterback, got knocked out, and we were behind 2 touchdowns, real close to the last of the game. Everybody thought we'd already lost the game. They put in a guy named Clint Longley. He's a quarterback out of Abilene Christian College. Nobody ever heard of him. And he came in, threw 2 touchdown passes, and we came back and beat the Washington Redskins that day. And nobody could understand how it was happening. We were in the locker room. The sports writers gathered over to this guy's locker by the name of Blaine Nye. He was our resident intellectual. He went to Stanford University, supposed to have been smart. If he was so smart, he probably wouldn't be playing football. But anyway, they said, "Blaine," said, "how do you figure it out? A complete unknown coming in and doing the feats of a Roger Staubach." And Blaine looked at him and says, "Well," said, "you know, I think that's the triumph of the uncluttered mind." And that's certainly the way I feel a lot of the times when I get up to speak. There's nothing here. It's just empty. But I certainly know my history once I get started. But, and like I say, I'm glad to be here. I was going to be here all weekend, but a friend of mine came in town that I went to school with down in Hattiesburg, and he's in recovery. Our other friend came up from Mobile, Alabama, and I had to go down to see those guys. So I just got up here this morning. I know Brad was a little nervous that I wouldn't show up, and I'm sorry to put you through that, Brad, but it worked out. It looks like you guys have had a great time. I'd like for each of you to look to the person on your right and left and shake their hand and tell them you love them. All right? Huh? All right. Yeah. All right. You know, as I go around sometimes, I work for a fertilizer company, and I make some presentations every now and then, and a lot of men's groups, men are, of course, in agriculture, and some women, too, but usually I have all the men stand up, and I said, now hug the guy on your right and left. And over here in Mississippi, man, they just stand there and look at each other. California, they hug. Texas, they hug one. You know, yeah. But it's always a good indication. But at least we can all say, I love you. I know there's so much love in these walls in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only place I can go to where people understand me totally, and they don't judge me. It's a place that taught me how to live, and on an ongoing basis, and man, I'm just so grateful to be sober today. I've been sober since February 10th, 1986. I think I said that, didn't I? Well, I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee. I was the youngest of 14 kids, and I grew up in a four-room house. They named me after Dwight Eisenhower and Douglas MacArthur, two great generals during World War II, and either that or they ran out of names. But I tell everybody I grew up in a close family if you count bodies per square foot. Also, I tell everybody my dad wasn't around very much. And I've gotten some laughs for that, too. He was around 14 times, I know. But Dad, everybody in my family was after the love and attention of my parents. And my parents were busy putting food on the table and clothes on our back. We were all scrapping for that attention. And my dad, at times, would come home at 11 o'clock at night. He'd gotten off from work and gone to a bar. And my mother would meet him at the door and start cursing him immediately. And, of course, wake everybody up in the house. And the next thing in the morning, start the same thing. She'd be on him, cursing him, wake everybody up, he broke two of her ribs once, and she stabbed him with a butcher knife once, and I had brothers that fought brothers and sisters fighting sisters, and it wasn't anything for the police to be at my house at 3:30 in the morning, and I mean, all of our neighbors could hear the arguments and the shouting and going on at the Lewis house, and so I grew up in that, and it seemed in my family that the worst people got the most attention. And I had some brothers who were bad street fighters and bad actors, and I tried to emulate them growing up on the streets. And by the time I was 12, I ran away from home twice, and when I was 13, I was sentenced to 2 years in state reform school. And by the grace of God, I didn't have to go to the 2 years in the state reform school. My mother got me out. She talked to the judge and let me out, and she got me into a private Lutheran school, which was two blocks from my home, and it's $15 a month, and there's no way she could afford that, and I believe today it's another part of God's grace for us, and he got me in up there, and the headmaster told me I could stay in the school if I did two things, and that was to come to school every day and stay out of fights, and I said, I can do that, and I went up there, and those kids accepted me as one of their own. You see, they didn't know that I was a little dumb, stupid, D.D. Lewis, white trash who lived across the tracks and that was never going to amount to anything. They accepted me as one of their own. And these were little rich kids. Their mothers and fathers drove them to school. And I went up there, and that headmaster put his arm around me, man, and it changed my whole life. This was my second time around the eighth grade. I did my homework every night because I saw him grab a girl by the hair of the head and smack her for not doing her homework. And I didn't want that to happen to me. And I went back to the ninth grade in public schools and did well, stayed out of trouble. And I was going to quit the ninth after the ninth grade and go to work, just like most people in my family had done. And my nephew played football at the high school, and he came down. He says, "Uncle Dee Dee, says, won't you try out for the high school football team?" I said, "Robert, they'll kill me. I'm 145 pounds, and they'll run all over me. Man, I'm just too small." And he said, "Oh, come on, you'll have fun." And he was tenacious, I guess you'd say. And I went up there and tried out for the football team. They put me at linebacker, center linebacker, 145 pounds. We had a running back by the name of McGinnis. He was 185 pounds. He was built like Tarzan. And he had little short teeth and dark. They got stunted somehow. Anyway, he was running the ball through the line one day, and the center was blocking on me, and I couldn't get over to tackle him. And he ran so close to me, I just stuck out my elbow and hit him right in the teeth. And they went everywhere. The teeth flew out, and the blood was spurting out, and he was on the ground curdling that blood and screaming. And the coaches started running, and I said, I was thinking, here's another deal they're going to kick me off of. And sure enough, the coaches ran over and grabbed me and said, "We love it! We love it!" And I found a home, I tell you. I found a place for my aggression and put it on the football field. And I'd been knocking people down and getting thrown in jail. And so I found a home. They started giving me 25 cents a day for lunch and giving me some nutriment to gain weight. Every now and then I'd get a pair of tennis shoes. And, you know, it was another deal. Here's other men putting their arm around me and loving me through high school. Don't worry about McGinnis. He got a whole new set of false teeth, and he became a ladies' man and quit football. And he's probably the smartest one of us all. But that started my career in football, and I made all-city and all-county. And in the school I was in, it was vocational high school, and I'm in the vocational side of it, which means you don't have to take the college preparatory English and all the sciences and everything. And I was in electrical shop, and about midway through my junior year, you see, I had gotten a whipping every day in grade school. That's the way it was. I didn't learn a thing. I thought I was stupid because my mother told me that every day. And I was one time in the third grade, I remember I studied spelling words at the kitchen table. Mom says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm studying my spelling words." She said, "You're too stupid to pass that test anyway." And I'd go to school and never write a thing down. So here I am, I'm in high school, and about midway in my junior year, coaches came up to me and said, "Look, Dee," he said, "all these colleges are writing us and asking about you. We think you're going to get a scholarship to play college football." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No, but you're going to have to change curriculums." I said, "What are you talking about, coach?" He said, "Well, you're going to have to take college preparatory English, and you're going to have to take chemistry and a foreign language." And I said, "You got to be kidding me." And he said, "No," he said, "we'll help you out." And they gave me some remedial courses, and I took... I passed chemistry with a D. I bet the teacher six packs of Cokes on our football games and brown-nosed my way through that. I took French, parlez-vous français, because the woman teacher had married a University of Tennessee football player, and I thought maybe she'd like football players, and she did. She gave me a D, and My wife still doesn't understand how I got out of English, but anyway, to get in college, you had at that time you had to make a 19 on the ACT test, and so they in my senior year I went over to the University of Tennessee to take this ACT test, 3-hour test, and I went in there and I tried as hard as I could for an hour, and then I just started checking them off, and I was out of there an hour and a half. I had first one out and thought I'd done good. And 2 weeks later, everybody got their grades at school and on their scores, and man, guys would run down the hall saying, "I made a 21, I made an 18, a 19, 24. And I looked at mine and I made a 7. I said, "Man, I ain't going anywhere to school." You know, that's out of the question. But I visited a lot of schools, and down here at Mississippi State, they said, "Dee," said, "we want you to come down and go to school with us." And I said, "Well, I got to figure out how to pass that test." And they said, "Well, come down here this summer and we'll give that test to you down here at our school." And so I came down to Mississippi State in the summer, and two other athletes showed up. We went up to the Dean of Student Affairs office, And he says, guys, I think your problem is reading. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the question for you, and then I'll read the possible answers, and then you guys pick one. We said, okay. And by the way, do you guys know why football players have big trapezius muscles up here on their shoulders and flat heads? Well, the teacher asks them a question, they go. And then they tell them the answer, and they go, ah. So we were some flatheads. But we were up there. He said, I think I'm going to read that. So he read the first question, then he read the four possible answers. And he says, which one do you think it is, guys? And we gave him one of these. And he said, well, I think it's more like C. And we said, okay, C. And he went on and did a few of those like that for us. And then he got up and went to the bathroom, and we were, we were kind of dumb in a way, but we were bright kids, in that we could read his answer sheet upside down while he was gone and figure it out. And then he'd come back and do a few more for us, and with all that help, it took us three times to pass that test. So, with a little uncertainty, I entered college, and a lot of fear. And I came down to Mississippi, and it was a great time for me. I knew I wouldn't be there for 2 weeks. I was too small and too dumb. And the coaches just put their arm around me and loved me through college and put two tutors on me for academics. And that's where I learned to drink in college. It worked immediately. I didn't drink in high school. I ran with a lot of guys that did. I had a double life going from the get-go, in the sense that in my high school, I wanted to be the stand-up athlete, stand-up type guy on one hand, and then on the other hand, I was out carousing around and doing things that I was ashamed of. So I had the double life going for a long time. But when I got to college, I started drinking. And it worked immediately. I was able to go to dances and dance and talk and to girls and sing. And it was amazing. I'd get up with a band. My first girlfriend told me I sang with Wilson Pickett at a fraternity party. And I said, you're kidding. I didn't remember it. But it worked right off the bat. And certainly, I'm sure I'm like a lot of us. I thought everybody else drank a lot worse than I did. I usually had to drive. I had to help them out of fights and stuff like this. But, of course, I know now I was in severe denial. But anyway, I went on and played at Mississippi State and made All-American in All-Southeastern Conference and Defensive Player of the Year in 1967. I had a lot of great honors. I played in a lot of All-Star games and All-American games. So I was getting the recognition I so desperately was seeking. And in 1968, I got drafted by the Dallas Cowboys in the sixth round. I came out to Dallas, and they had already drafted two linebackers in front of me in the draft. And these were big, fast guys, great football players, and I saw the writing on the wall. I came out to Dallas, and I knew I wouldn't be there any time at all. I was too small, too slow. And they drafted these guys in front of me, and I went to training camp, and they put me at offensive center. And anyway, while these other guys were improving themselves, I got to snap the ball on offense. So I knew I was going to get cut, but I hung in there, and the guy that they were going to keep, the linebacker that was so good, he got drafted into the Army. And I slid in the back door and made the Dallas Cowboys football team. That was in 1968. It was a completely new life for me. At Mississippi State, we won one game my senior year. We went out and beat Texas Tech 6-3. We passed on third down. It surprised them. We scored. Usually we were punting on third down. We were bad. When I got to Dallas, man, we started beating people 50 points. It was unbelievable. My first game was I had to go play in a Chicago All-Star game with the All-Stars. We played the Green Bay Packers on a Saturday night in Chicago. The next day, we flew to Canton, Ohio, and we played for Dallas against Chicago Bears in the Canton Hall of Fame game, and which I think they're playing today or this weekend. And anyway, went down there and we were playing Chicago Bears, and man, these guys had on these big dark blue uniforms, and had Dick Butkus and a guy named Fred Obradovich, and I mean, they were just mean, and they were knocking guys out, and it was dusty, and Butkus was killing people, cursing, and I just knew I'd never make it. I mean, it's just too bad for me. And we had a real rodeo cowboy that played for us by the name of Walt Garrison, and Butkus, middle linebacker. I mean, he walked around like this. And he's, you know, chewing on his tongue. He's probably one of us, excuse me, Dick, I didn't mean that, so he told Garrison, he said, look, Garrison, you come through this hole again, I'm going to bite your head off. And Walt said, yes, you do. You have more brains in your stomach than you do in your head. Be quiet, Walt. Don't get him mad. But I just knew it was too rough for me. We got two fights with them. They won the fights. It took John Wilbur took his helmet off, was going to hit one of them with it, and Wilbur played for us. They took Wilbur's helmet and started beating him with it, and his benches over ran out on the field. And, I mean, it was just too much for me. I couldn't understand what was going on, but I knew one thing. Here I was in Dallas, Texas, lonely. I'd just gotten married, had no friends, and playing second team, second fiddle. And man, I had my night, one night a week. It was the boys' nights out. It was on Thursday night, and I'd go down to the little joint where they're playing country music and just crying my beard, and you know, it's awful. I never thought I was lonely though, you know. I mean, that word wasn't even in my vocabulary. So anyway, we went on. We played the New York Giants my rookie year up there. Don Meredith was the quarterback. We beat them 50-something points. And that never happened to me before. And after the game, we were taking off at the airport. Right when we left the ground, there's a big explosion. And man, the plane went banking out over the bay, and everybody knew we were going to dump our gas and have a crash. And the stewardesses were on their knees moving these boxes, coolers, to hell all the Coca, soft drinks, and beer. And people were panicking, getting ready to panic. And Dan Reeves, the head coach for the Falcons now, this guy Pete Gent, who wrote North Dallas 40, was back there playing loud rock and roll music. And Reeves says, cut that off, you SOB, or I'll kill you. And people were panicking, man. And people were praying. And I looked across the aisle, and there was Don Meredith smoking a cigarette. He said, it's been a good one. He was ready. These guys were too big, too bad, and too cool. I mean, it was like Hollywood. But I hung in there for a number of years, 14 years with Dallas. It was a great trip, a lot of partying, a lot of... I feel like Bill Wilson talks about in his story there, the opening of the book, where he talks of about when he got into the service overseas. They were drinking, and he was part of life. And he was a leader in times of hilarity, you know. And I certainly had that when I arrived. But I played with Dallas for 14 years. We went to 5 Super Bowls, and I got to play 27 playoff games. And, I mean, if you look at Dallas's schedule or record over those years, in 68 we were in the playoffs, 69 playoff, 70 Super Bowl, 71 Super Bowl, 72 National Championship game, 73 National Championship game, 75 Super Bowl, 76 National Championship game, 77 Super Bowl, 78 Super Bowl, 79 playoffs, 80 and 81 National Championship games. And it was god-awful record for anybody to be a part of. And my last game was against San Francisco 49ers in 1982, actually, but the season of 81, when Joe Montana was throwing the ball to Dwight Clark in the end zone. He jumps up and catches it. They dubbed that pass to catch. I'm number 50 chasing Montana in the film clip. And a very frustrating film clip. I never catch him. And still haven't caught him. I have the fantasy. When I start thinking about it or dreaming about it, I blitz on that play. And I hit Joe Montana right in the chest. The ball goes up. I grab it. and run it all the way in for a touchdown. And it just never happens that way. And they beat us, and that was my last game. I had played football for 26 years of my life. That was my identity. That's who I was. I thought I was ready to get out of the game. I had money and property and family, everything else. I had everything lined up. And the year before, I got to make a national Bic razor commercial in New York City. And I was elected the most popular cowboy and Miller Lite Man of the Year. A lot of good things were happening to me. And then right after I retired, I got to make a Miller Lite beer commercial, which I thought was a professional football player's dream. And it was about 3 months after football, I retired from football, I started having thoughts of suicide. And it scared me to death. And I couldn't tell anybody. I was such a closed-up person. It was and one day I went to play golf with a guy that retired the same year I did, and we're driving over there, and he says, Dee Dee, says, I'm scared to death. I said, what's the matter? He said, well, I've been having thoughts of suicide. And instead of saying, yeah, great, man, finally talking to somebody that can empathize with what I'm going through, and we can talk about this, and instead of saying that, I looked at him and said, oh, really? Like I'd never had a problem with that, but that's where I was. I was so closed up, and I understand today, like a lot of us in there, I grew up thinking that it was a sign of weakness if you showed anybody any vulnerability, and I pretended it all was well all my life, and I was hiding behind a big mask. But anyway, I took a job in the oil field supply business in Dallas. And I'd take guys out for lunch, and we'd have a few drinks, and they'd go back to the office, and I'd go back to the bar. And I had a little farm outside of Dallas, and I was out there a lot drinking, hiding out, and spent my weekends out there. And after one weekend of a big drinking spree, my wife says, Dee Dee, if you don't stop drinking, I'm going to divorce you. And I'd heard her say that many times. And what I always heard her say was, Dee Dee, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to end up like my dad. And her dad died of alcoholism. He suffocated in his own vomit. Or I heard her say, Dee Dee, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to end up like your brothers. And my brothers, I had one brother who was assistant manager down to Bootleggers. And he was high in management. But my brothers drank this old bathtub Sploh whiskey. I mean, it just knocked them out. And you get up at 7 and be going to school, and one of them be laying out in the front yard trying to get a suntan on the roof of his mouth. And you can imagine that. And see, that's who I thought she said, if you don't quit drinking, you're going to end up like them. But I heard her this time, and I knew she was serious. So I went to talk to a guy in a car business in Dallas, W.O. Banks, and he'd been in AA for a long time. And this is after the big bender that weekend. My eyes are all bloodshot. And I said, W.O., we talked. And about 15 minutes later, I said, W.O., you think I'm an alcoholic? He said, yeah, I do. And, man, I didn't want to be an alcoholic. Because, you know, you can imagine the image. I just went through what alcoholics were. And I didn't think I was that way. But I was in denial. And so in February of 1983, W.O. told me where to go and what to do. And I went out to my first AA meeting out in Plano, Texas, a little house out there, and I cracked the screen door and then opened the door. As soon as I stuck my head in, everybody went, you know, it's like when you smoke dope, you go into a restaurant, as soon as you walked in, everybody looked at you, right? I mean, that's not self-centeredness, right? It's the height of it. But anyway, I walked in there, and everybody in the AA, it was my fear, you know, I thought they all turned around to look at me, and I was going to be recognized, and they're going to know I was a weak willy and all that crap. But anyway, I made it through that first meeting. They had a speaker. And the big thing I remember is everybody coming up wanting me to take a chip afterwards. And I would like to tell them, just let me out of here. I want to get out of here. But I started going back to AA. I felt like this was certainly the place for me. This is where could become that stand-up guy. And I was drunk in 3 months. And for 3 years, I was in and out of AA in 3 treatment centers. I entered AA for my wife, and in the back of my mind, I had the idea, the thought, that I'll get sober for 6 months, and then I'll go to the mountains and blow it off, and then I can come back. Nobody would ever know. I mean, we're not like that, but I was. And I entered AA that way. Plus, I was working for Miller Lite Beer. When you make a commercial for them, they make you Miller Lite All-Star. So anywhere Miller Lite, any of these distributorships around the country needed a Miller Lite All-Star, they just call up Milwaukee, and then they'd send somebody, you know, they were paying us $2,000 a day, and I was calling Milwaukee a lot. Event would be like in Fort Smith, Arkansas, the dealership was having a big barbecue, and I went up there and drank beer and pitched horseshoes all day. Got drunk and stunk, signed autographs, got my $2,000, and that was a life that was great, you know. But here I was in AA and still working for Miller. I mean, this was the double life part that I wasn't willing to give up, I guess. And I had the idea that I could go up to these bars anywhere in the country, and you go in there, and I had it made up that I could tell them I couldn't drink because I had an infection and I was taking antibiotics. Everybody knows you can't drink on antibiotics, or you're not supposed to. How many of us have drank on antibiotics? So I'd go in, have that down pat. That's going to be my reason for not drinking, and I'd go into the bar, and I'd have a cowboy hat on. I had that persona. I wore cowboy boots. I never wore boots in my life. But anyway, I had a hat. Never had a cowboy hat on in my life. But I had that cowboy persona about me. Western pants, Western coat. I never had fringes. That may be coming up, by gosh. And I had my story now. And I go into the bar, and the guy'd say, "What do you want to drink?" He'd put that Miller Lite up there, and I'd say, "I can't drink, guy, I tell you." "What? A Miller Lite All-Star, not drinking? Give me a beer." Hey, I didn't even get the chance to tell him I had that infection. I was so ashamed so I'd start another spree. But for 3 years, it was a killer. I thought I was going to be the guy that couldn't get it. And I ended up losing everything that I held dear. And that's my family, all my money, my property, my dignity. My best friend ended up being a cocaine dealer. I was this close to the bottom. I came out of that last treatment center just as crazy as I'd ever been. And I was living in a little one-bedroom apartment. And I came out of there, and one thing had changed. I started reaching out for help, which I was always afraid of, because I was afraid of rejection. And in there, they told me about, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the praying and how to pray. And at night, take your slippers, slide them up under the bed, and while you're on your knees, ask God to keep you sober. And in the morning when you get up, to get on your knees, get those slippers, why don't you just ask Him to keep you sober? And that was a profound statement for me, because I grew up in a Baptist church, and I heard that preacher preach, and he preached like it was a psalm, you know. It was a song. It was so beautiful, and it rolled. And I never could do that, of course, because of all the shame and guilt and the things I had backed up, you know. God couldn't love me. But anyway, I got back home. I started praying, and I started reaching out for help in these meetings. And I was sober about 2 months, and I knew I needed to get a sponsor, somebody to lead me through this program, a mentor. My first sponsor that I ever asked in that old club, within that 3 months that I was sober that first time, I asked him to be my sponsor because he was next to me during the Lord's Prayer after the meeting. He said, at the spot where it says, "Forgive us for our trespasses," he said, "Forgive us for our short passes." And I thought, well, that's kind of neat. You know, this guy's sports conscious. He would understand. We could joke around together, and it didn't last, you know. I mean, but I knew I had to have somebody to help me, and I had two guys picked out at the club I was going to, and I liked what they'd said and everything, and But I was afraid to ask them for help because I was afraid of rejection, afraid they'd turn me down. It was the damnedest thing. You've heard it before, that 40-pound phone, you can't pick it up. And, well, anyway, this one particular night, I got on my knees and prayed and asked God to send one of those guys into my life and lead me through this program. And it wasn't 5 minutes and one of them called. Now, that was a miracle to me. And I asked him to be my sponsor. And he said, what are you doing tomorrow night? I said, well, nothing. And he immediately got me in a plan of action. We went through. He said, come go with me. And we went up to Terrell State Hospital over in Terrell, Texas, and carried an AA meeting up there to the jitter joint. And he got me into action. And we started studying the big book. And I'd read the big book 5 times at least. But we started studying it. He gave me a section to read every week. He said, I want you to read it 15 minutes a day. That's all for me. Now, you can read anything you want to on your own. But I want you to read that for me on your own. Then we'd meet on the weekends and we'd go over it. And, man, the book came alive for me, and it changed my life. When you start coming to these meetings and the time that people start coming up to you and say, you know, you've changed. You're changing. What do you mean I'm changing? Just, I don't know. The way you talk, what you say, the way you carry yourself anymore. You know then that something's happening to you. I like what Jim Williams says. He says, you'll know when you know you don't know. And that's a very profound statement for all of us in the sense that when I got to working with a sponsor, he was an engineer. He taught me the big book that way, and we started working through it and working the steps. For me to understand the first step, I'd gone through the steps up to the fifth step three times in treatment. And I'd wrote my fourth step in an hour and a half, and the next day I'd go give it to the chaplain, or whoever they had me to tell it to. But that's not the way we did it here. And the people I work with today, I say, look, here's the way I'm going to do it, because the guy that taught me, that's how he taught me how to do it. And this is the only way I know to do it. Now, I had a friend that I loved him to death. He was in the program 10 years. He just died of cancer. And he was going to work with a guy. And he called me and he says, Dee Dee, he says, look, we're on the fourth step. He said, can you give me some help with this? And I said, well, just do it the way your sponsor taught you. He said, well, my sponsor didn't teach me. He said, we were in a book study. And that's how I went through the steps. And I thought to myself, ain't that something? I think book studies are great. I think step studies are great. But this sponsor, he was right on top of me. He got me to understand that I was powerless. Not only over alcohol, over everything. And once I got that idea in my head, it clicked. That, Dee Dee, you can't do it. You can't get off of this booze. And you can't direct your family that's living down another part of the city. I started understanding the philosophy behind them being powerless. And certainly I was powerless over booze. I never understood the effect of craving. I could not understand in my life. In 1975, I went to speak to a high school banquet, and I stopped at my favorite bar to have a drink, and I ended up at the Indianapolis 500 for 3 days. And I never could understand that because, as you know, we all have good intentions. I'm just going to have a couple of drinks. You end up pounding on the bar at 3, and I never could understand that. And that's why these things are happening. That's why I was powerless over this great mind-altering drug. But anyway, so he got me to understand all that, and then I got into the second and third step of finding that if I couldn't do it, if I didn't have the power, who could? And of course, I had to. I like the part in there where Bill Wilson talks of his friend coming to visit him. And he looked at his friend and he said, you've got religion. He said, you bet. And in there where it talks about being willing, open and willing and having some humility to crack the door on looking at God in a different way. All the prejudices of the past he was talking about would enter his mind when you talked of this boss of the universe. But where we can start creating and have the idea of creating our own God, in essence, I'm not afraid of that today. If anybody has the Coke machine or the club or Buddha or anybody else, or if somebody wants to come in and defend Jesus Christ, that's fine. Today, I don't have to worry about that because my God's big enough to handle it. And I think people come into this program, I think me, you, and everybody else, we come into this program spiritually broke. And a guy in the Fellowship of Christians Athletes asked me, said, Dee Dee, why can't you take and just have these people believe in Jesus Christ and forgive your sins? And I said, well, the reason that don't work because we come in here spiritually dead. It never worked before. If it worked before, we'd have done it. But the idea of coming here creating our own God, which is a great thing for me, and we then going into the four step, and it took me almost 4 months to do a four step, and I'd done them an hour and a half in those treatment centers. I mean, when I started looking at some of my past and the feelings, the emotion that would come rushing up on me, it would be so devastating, I'd just have to stop everything, pick up the phone, run to a meeting, and I was already writing, and I was praying, and that to me, that's the process of this program, is going to meetings. It's amazing what we get when we go to the meetings. We hear the answer. We get the solution. It's the greatest thing in the world. I meet with a bunch of men every Monday morning, and none of them are alcoholics, but man, they need our program so bad. Nobody else has it. We got it. It's a beautiful thing where we can come and work out our life and our problems and hear everybody else. We're not judged. And the last meeting I went to in Dallas, I had fear all over me. I was going to get fired. I mean, all this stuff up here, the committee rambling on. And I went to the meeting, and the meeting was on fear. And how many times does it happen that you get what you need when you go to those meetings? Meetings, makers, make it. Meeting makers make it. And I try to go to one as often as I can, everywhere I can. And when I'm out of town, I was so fearful of going to meetings. And the first meeting that I went to out of town was in Hugo, Oklahoma. And my sponsor told me, if you ever get any town you go into, so if you want to know where the AA meeting is or if they have one, just call the fire department or the police department. They'll tell you. Those guys know. And sure they know. And they say, well, yeah, there's one over here across the river. And I went, and there was four people there. And it was a very good meeting. And now my fear is not so much, but I still have some fear about going to a new meeting, but it's a blessing for me always. And so I did. The process of the program, as I see it, is going to meetings, picking up that telephone, that 40-pound phone, calling someone else. Women, you guys have already know the solution to a lot of us hardtail problems, is women, when they need to talk about their problems, they don't need any answers, they just need to talk about them. And in the talking, they get solutions. They figure it out. And that's what we have to adopt. That's the way I believe AA is. We got to pick up that phone and call somebody and say, hey, Joe, here's what's happening. Let me tell you what she did today. Or he did, or whatever. Whatever like you want to do, blame it on somebody else. But that's the process of the program, I believe, is writing, picking up the phone, talking to somebody, coming to meetings, and praying. And that fourth step was great for me. It also, there's a lot still being revealed. The fifth step is telling someone my whole story and not have them laugh at me or anything like that. And then getting into step 6 and 7, I breezed right over that with my sponsor after doing the fifth step. He says, now go on and read the 6 and 7 step in the 12 and 12 and then the big book and we'll talk about it. Well, I went home. I was so exhausted from telling my fifth step that I fell asleep reading the 6 and 7. I immediately went to 8. And I'm still trying to catch the meaning of 6 and 7. In a sense, I went to 8, made my list, and I was so eager to go out and make amends. And my sponsor told me, said, Dee Dee, said, I don't want you to make any amends until you run it by me. And you tell me who you're going to make amends for, and I want to know why. And I want to know what you're going to say so that you don't run in there and have to make another amends for going in there and messing it up. And And I got a chance. My mom and dad had died. I got a chance to go to a shrimp cemetery and went to a grove of cedar trees. And I got to call them in and apologize for what I'd done to them. All my life, I thought they'd done it to me. And I got to, and when my sponsor says, "Now, Dee Dee, now that you've done that," says, "When you think of them, you can think of nothing but the good stuff." And it's amazing that the good stuff keeps coming and keeps coming and keeps coming. I never thought my dad had taught me anything. But, you know, things come out about my dad often now. Little things I never even thought about, or I pushed back underneath the hate I had for him. And it's a terrific thing. And I went to make amends to Coach Landry. Scared to death, I went in there and I apologized. I told him I took pills when I played ball and I probably at times took too many. And anyway, at the end, he said, "Dee Dee," says, "if you're looking for forgiveness from me, you got it." And he got up and gave me a hug. And it's been a beautiful experience making amends. I made amends to one of my nieces for a very shameful act. And I felt it was time that she was in therapy and that she could handle this. And I went and made amends to her. And she says, "Yeah, Uncle Dee Dee," said, "I hear you, what you're saying, but that's not the only thing you did." So she added more to it, and I apologize for that too. But I'm willing today to make those amends when they come up, where I see the people and run into them. I'm willing to do that. And the greatest step for me, not the greatest, but one of the ones I use often, is the 10th step. And I do. Journaling for me has been wonderful. I mean, it's just been great because I get it out of my mind. I get it on paper. I can see what's going on, and I've had, this is my third journal I'm on now, and my first one was full of my wife. I mean, it was everything she had done to me, and so then I got married, and my new bride, I got to tell you this story if we have time here, here I'm just got married, and I feel like my wife is reading my journal. For some reason. I just had that feeling. You know her nose, right? So in there, and she's got her car, and I've got my car, and she accused me of taking the hammer to her car. And I wanted to many times. Well, she told me, I've got to say this, Billy, my wife told me not to say anything about her. But here, I'm going to break her. I'm going to tell her I didn't say anything. But anyway. Here's the car, and I've wanted to take a hammer to it because that's her car instead of our car, and she I couldn't put a clothes basket on top of it, scratch it or something. Anyway, I've got all this resentment built up, and so I want to find out if we're in therapy too together. I want to find out if she's reading my journal. Well, I put in my journal that I took a hammer to her car. And I hope she doesn't find out, like this. And it was about 3 years later, we're in therapy. Same guy. And, second marriages, how you try to blend families and all that. 85% of second marriages don't work. Isn't that something? So get through the second one, get on to your third one, you'll be all right. Not really. We've worked hard on this one. 3 years later, we're in therapy. And for as long as the time, my wife has been she doesn't trust me. And finally in therapy, I said, "Look, I've had enough of this. You never trust me. What's going on? What makes you think this? And you've always talked about me hitting that car. What is it about?" And she says, "Well," she says, "I got to get honest. It's time to get honest." She said, "And I hate to say this, but I read your journal." "Oh, no." She said, "And in there you wrote in your journal that you'd set the hammer to the car." And I'd forgotten all about it. It's 3 years later, man. And the therapist is looking at me, and she's looking at me for an answer. I said, "I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I haven't hit your car with anything. I couldn't figure it out." So we broke up in the therapy session. And so I went home that night. I got real quiet, and it came to me. I wrote it in my journal. years ago, never thought anything about it. And I went back the next week. Now you can imagine, this would never fly. They still don't believe me. I went in there. I told them, I said, hey, I wrote that in my journal just to see if she was reading it. And they both of them went. So what? Great story, eh? Anyway, be careful where you write your journal. But the 10th step has gotten me back to step 6 and 7 every time. And most of the time it gets me back there because I'm on my knees pleading for mercy for God to take this from me, because I keep stepping in it, doing something. My wife is thrashing me with something that I do wrong. And usually I've stepped on a bunch of toes, or stuffed my feelings and then had a breakout or something, and I'm usually in my room after writing on my knees asking God to take this defect of character from me. And in there, I understand today we all have instincts, but I have taken mine. I'm sure a lot of us have taken those instincts and carried them way, way over. One of my big ones, and as you can guess, is for recognition, to be authentic, and for someone to, what's the word, authenticate me, or what would that word be, to validate me, for you to treat me with respect and as a stand-up person. And so I take that instinct of wanting to be validated, to be authentic, to be respected, to be of some value, and I've taken it and gone way to the extreme. Because even when you look at me like you don't like me, I blow up. I can read something into that. But it always causes me trouble. I immediately get into a shame spiral. And when I get into the shame, I get angry because I'm a no-good SOB then, and I want to fight you. And so I'm on my knees begging for mercy, asking God, humbly asking Him to remove this defect of character, get me the right size. And that's not, I have a lot of other character defects besides that. But the step 10 brings me right back to 6 and 7. And I know about 6 and 7. I know about 10. Seeking God in step 11, I try to do that. I've been in and out of that, setting time for God and meditation and to work on my spiritual life. After I got sober, I got back in church. After 2 years, I got back into the Bible, into my religion, and I took it way to the edge over here. And it's like I'd start memorizing Bible verses and wanting my wife to sing in church, and she hated that. It's like she was wanting me to do it different, and she grew up a Methodist, and they never sing in the Methodist church the way we sing. But anyway. I gave her the impression that she was a step or two below me spiritually. I don't know how I could do that. So here I am. We get in an argument, and I go back in the bedroom. That's my cave. And I go back there and read the Bible, of course, and memorizing all these verses. It was the guys in my group who were memorizing them. And anyway, she comes through the bedroom. She's walking like this. Yeah, you're some kind of Christian. You are. I say, hey, you know what it says about you in here? It says it's better for a man to sleep on the corner of the roof than in the house with a contentious woman. I can get it right. And that's not the way to quote Scripture. I always done that way when I was a kid. So I had to work through a lot of stuff, and I'm coming back to the center with some balance now after a long, long time of beating people up and not really being able to see it. I've got a few friends around me that love me just a little bit less than I love myself. And they tell me what they see, and I get to tell them my problems, and they give me some answers. And a lot of times it's hard to hear. But I think a guy in one of our meetings back in Dallas said it best when he said that D.D. says it's like... when you get married and come into AA, or he says, when you come into AA the first time, it's like getting married. You're never going to get your way again. So I'm coming to that place to where you get in, the way you get into full acceptance is just to be beaten down. That's not right. That's the victim's role. But I think the whole program is leading us to a position where we can say, this is happening, I'm right where I'm supposed to be, things are happening just exactly the way they're supposed to be, and I'm going to accept it. I'm not there. I'm really not there, but I think that's the place where God wants us to be, and it's going to take a lifetime to get there. Step 12 is, I wish I could carry and do these principles in all my affairs. I don't. I'm still in process. I make a lot of mistakes. One of the big ones, it just happened a few years ago. My wife made a big pot of chili, and I was mad at her, and I took her cigarette butts and put it in there, and she didn't like that. Told everybody, a little small thing. One of the things I keep doing, I'm learning that these women are something else. And you know you are. I mean, I going to school over here in Mississippi, I really like this place, so I've come over here to Tallulah. And I'm talking to a guy at Mississippi State over there, and I said, Price, what's the name of that guy from Mississippi State that makes those rocking chairs? And anyway, he sends me someplace. I got the wrong rocker anyway. The one I was looking for was from Greg Hawkins that makes them up there in Vaughan. But so I got one from this guy named Biggers. And I get it in my car. And man, I'm so proud. I'm coming home and I pull up to the house and my wife comes out and she says, what are you going to do with that? Well, I'm going to put it in the house. Not in my house, you ain't. I forgot to ask her. It was her nest and you get married, all my furniture's gone now. All the pictures, all the artwork, stuff gone somewhere. It's her house. And the sooner you realize that, guys, you'd be better off. My part of the house is cleaning the commode and shower. Poor guy. Now, it's good, I'm telling you. You can imagine what it would be like if I was still drinking. But I tell you, I've got two daughters, 127, 121. I've got a stepson that just turned 17. What a handful he is. And my daughters, I try to control them forever. Now I'm trying to love them. I've had to go to Al-Anon to learn to detach with love, really showing me what kind of guy I am. But I believe it's all this thing called life is about pulling us out as men and women. What does it mean, pulling us out? It's like when you heat gold or silver, you're trying to get the pure stuff, the dross comes to the top. We want to get the impurities out, and relationships do that to all of us. I think that's why it's important to have them. This program has given me a way to live. And like I say, I'm still not there. I've got to go to meetings, as many as I can. I forget real quick. So I got to keep coming back and hearing it over and over and over again. And by the grace of God, I'm still in there. I just feel so good that I still have the desire to come to meetings and to work with people. And God keeps doing it for me over and over and over again. Many blessings that He's given me in every facet of my life. And I never thought I would ever win by surrendering. And it turns out that's the way it works. And I'm glad you guys asked me, little old dumb, slow, white trash D.D. Lewis, who grew up across the tracks, to come down here and share my life with you. Because it means a lot to me. And I'm certainly not that guy today, never was. I just thought I was in my head. But today, I heard a guy speak on radio. He says, the me I see is the me I'll be. And today I see a pretty good guy most of the time. And you tell me that, and I know that today. I appreciate you. I love you. Hang in there, and it'll get better. Thank you.